This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show.
To the Aftershock Central Podcast. Cha-ching! Martin, Travis, Ronnie, all here. Full Voltron together again.
Yeah! What's up, Shockers?
Ronnie, welcome back. How was your assignment?
It was great.
Great. Great. I'm happy to hear it.
I know, I heard that episode and you guys were really worried about me. And you said you said you weren't there to talk about me, which is lies.
I'm always around to talk about you, buddy.
We got some news. I got a piece of news.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Tell me.
At cons that Aftershock's going to be in, or be at, like this coming weekend at Denver, they're going to have shock boxes for $75.
All right. Tell me about the shock box.
Okay. It's going to have $175 to $230 worth of merchandise in them. You're going to get one CBCS graded comic.
Really?
One specialty book, which means a hardcover, and possibly even a hardcover that's signed by the creative team.
Huh.
10 first issues of a assorted Aftershock lot, like, say, A Walk Through Hell and Baby Teeth, Alters, blah, blah, blah. One trade paperback, one complete run of Aftershock title.
Holy moly.
Three variant covers of a title.
Holy moly.
And then five Aftershock preview or special comics. So like the little ash cans or free comic book day or something like that.
That's a damn, you said how much? $75?
$75.
That's a steal.
Yep. And it's a mystery box because not every box is the same, so.
Sure. But you guaranteed those things.
Yep.
You're not pulling my chain, right? You're not pulling a Skype on me and telling me one thing that's not true.
Nope.
Huh.
And it'll be at NYCC. And like I said, it's going to start being at the cons starting with Denver this weekend.
Yeah, so Denver. What I'm hearing there is you could order more than one. You know, it's different stuff in each. So
yeah, you could go to the booth and buy two mystery boxes and not come out with the same thing.
Oh wait, so no two are alike.
No two are alike. It's just mystery stuff.
God, dizzle.
Yeah,
I like this.
Yeah,
that's genius.
I mean, not only are you getting a specialty book like a hardcover, but you have a chance to get a hardcover that's signed by the creative team. Plus, you get a whole run of floppies of a Aftershock title, whether it's Baby Teeth, Animosity, Black Eyed Kids, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then a trade paperback, and then five special comics, and then 10 first issues of assorted ones. So maybe the 10 first issues you might get, you know, two number ones of Black Eyed Kids if you bought two boxes, but
mm-hmm.
And then, you know, a graded CBCS.
That's insanity.
Yeah.
That's insanity.
Yeah, and 95% of the graded CBSs are 9/8 that are going into the box.
No kidding.
Yep. So if you have Ronnie luck, you'll be that 5% that gets a 9.6 of something.
Very true. Wow. That's awesome, dude. I'm a little upset now because I was looking over the Heroes Con list. Because I'll be at Heroes on Saturday, and I don't see Aftershock on the list. What's up with that?
Yeah, that's because they're going to be in Denver.
Well, who cares about Denver? What's Denver to me, Ronnie?
I don't know.
Nothing.
Kind of like
absolutely
what,
nothing.
What C2E2 was to you.
Oh, don't remind me.
Yeah, they're probably just trying to meet up with Mike Myers, right?
Mike's going to be at Heroes.
Yeah, Mike's going to be at Heroes.
All right, never mind.
Yeah, I'm going to hang out with all those guys, Mike and Daryl and Chris and everybody. Damn it, Aftershock. So I wonder if I can send Joe an email and have him send me a box.
That could be possible.
Mm-mm-mm. Well, that's cool, though. Even through all that, I'm still very happy with this box. It sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah.
That's good news. I totally missed that. How did I miss that?
Probably because you're not on Facebook.
Facebook. That's for old people.
Well, yes, it is.
The kids are on Twitter and Snapchat. Come on, bro.
I know.
All right, well, that's cool. I'm glad that you're still on Facebook to relay the message to me. That's very awesome.
I'm just doing what I do.
Is that the only bit of news that we have?
Yeah. Yep.
Cool. That's big, dude. That's like a steal. How much is a trade? The trades are like $18, right?
Well, the Dreaming Eagles one is like $30 itself.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah.
So
yeah, the hardcovers, I think, are $39.
So it ranges from $15 to $75, I would say.
Amazing. You just blew my mind, dude. That is genius. Whoever came up with that, genius.
Yeah. Well, and like when we go to cons, what do we see everybody carrying around is those stupid mystery boxes. No matter if they're like TARDIS mystery boxes or the Mario mystery boxes or whatever, everybody's paying for them and getting them.
Dude, I don't know about at other cons, but at my local con, they sell out by like Sunday morning.
Yeah. Yep.
It's insane. All right. Well, that's cool. That's awesome. Any other tidbits? No new book announcements that I missed?
Nope.
Great. That's great. Let's talk about some books then. How about that?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Where would you guys like to start? Travis, I'll let you pick. We have four books to talk about.
How about we go with Ronnie's favorite book?
I like it. All right. A Walk Through Hell is written by Garth Ennis with art by Goran Suzuka. And, man, I should have pulled these books up. Colors by Ives Scorsina and letters by Rob Steen. See, Ronnie, you could pronounce all these names.
Yep, I probably could in my head.
Except Garth Ennis.
Yeah, that's the hardest one.
All right, so let's talk about this one. Ronnie, you were not a big fan of the first issue.
Right.
I understand why. How'd you feel about this one?
The first third of the book, I would say. Which I guess would be the character development or the agent development. It seemed like it drug a little bit, but then after that, when we actually got into the meat and potatoes of the story, kind of like mm-hmm. the first issue, then it was awesome.
Travis?
Yeah, I think I was kind of pretty in for the first issue, although I definitely have questions about where certain things were going, if they were attached at all. You know, I thought this issue was a lot more focused, and obviously, you know, not to be reductive, but you know, the kind of image of Hunziker like blowing his brains out, like on and on, without ends, like I thought was pretty provocative. So I thought this is a great follow up. And let me ask you guys this, just throwing it out there, like, is it safe to assume at this point that they're in hell? That this is like everybody there is basically in hell?
Well,
yeah, maybe.
You mean the two agents that are in the warehouse?
Yeah, like they're dead, right? Like they have no pulse.
They have no pulse. They're not breathing.
Yep. But
are they in hell though? I mean, I know it's called a walk through hell, but
yeah.
Well, some people's conception of hell is that like you relive your worst moment or whatever, the most painful thing or your biggest fear or whatever over and over, you know. Like that the apt punishment is, you know, how you've transgressed or whatever. So like that, I think, like falls in line with the idea that this guy has to keep shooting himself in the head over and over.
Hmm.
Well, this is my question. It's from the first issue when we had the mall shooting, right?
Yeah.
What that, and then having the agents sit down and talk about their everyday lives. In the
right.
first issue and in the second issue, is that going to tie in somehow? That's my big question, right? Because obviously it's this stuff going through hell figuratively isn't really happening just in the warehouse, because the SWAT team all did a group suicide there in the van.
Right.
And then we at this point, I gotta assume that the shooters in the mall were under the same influence.
Yeah. And plus whatever this like child abducting, murdering group of people is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, since you posed that question, I'm going to pose another question. How convinced are you guys that the stuff that Ronnie hates is not the actual stuff that's happening in hell? How do we know that all that is real? That is what I'm saying.
Mm.
You know, what if the story actually starts when they enter the warehouse and all the flashback stuff and all that, none of that is happening. It's all stuff that they're reliving as they're going through this journey.
Oh, like one of the agents was in the mall when it happened type thing?
Right, right.
That'd be a cool twist.
I mean, I'm just trying to see, like, you know, how this is different than other things. I got like a big, oh God, what was that movie? Event Horizon. Did you guys ever see that?
Yep.
Yeah.
This issue was a lot like Event Horizon in the way that it played out. From like the body horror stuff with the agent shooting himself repeatedly in the head, and I mean, we assume the gun was reloading itself automatically somehow, right? Because they talked about how there were more bullets there than would fit in a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So there's obviously some weird mystical magical stuff going on at the same time, and I don't know. With what I know about Garth Ennis and his writing, I think there's too much emphasis placed on the mundane stuff in this story for it not to play a key part in the rest of the story, right? And I mean, we're only 2 issues in, and I'm not. Do we know how many issues this is? Is it 6?
I believe it's 6, but I can't confirm that.
Okay. I mean, we can assume 5 or 6 issues for Aftershock. We're only 2 issues into the story. We still don't know anything, right? All we're seeing is like the repercussions of being in this warehouse. I don't think we should assume that the stuff that's happening out in the real world is actually stuff that's happening, or at least stuff that's happening
in real time.
In real time, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, Martin, I think that certainly my kind of like, you know, general philosophy, like with something with a medium like comics, is that especially in a limited series, every kind of piece of real estate is important. So, you know, if I have to assume that the stuff that in the first issue that we're like, what is this, actually connects in a meaningful way, because why else would you spend pages and pages on it? So, like, I'm expecting it to pay off in some way. And kind of jumping off that, you know, I thought there were other things in the first issue, maybe in the same dialogue, that like set up stuff in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Like specifically, they mention in the first issue the place where ghosts take children.
Right, right.
Which they mention this issue. And meanwhile, we have a storyline wherein, you know, somebody is traveling around all over the Southwest and abducting children with, you know, people who then maybe disappear or they're former offenders or something. And, you know, somehow that connects to this warehouse. So I'm interested in that. And also, they mention in the first issue, Hunziker down on his knees.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we see him like in this issue, like that's how we see him. So I think there is clearly a lot in that first issue that is developing already in this issue.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I don't think we can see it all yet. I know, Ronnie, you hated it, but I guarantee you when we get to issue like 4 or 5, you're going to want to go back and read that stuff that you hated to get some clues and make some new connections to the storyline itself.
Yeah, yeah. And let me clarify that I hated it because it felt so out of place from the story. Not so much that, you know, it was, I mean, I didn't really care that it was like real time tweet type stuff too, but
yeah.
As long as it pays off, then I'm fine with it.
Yep. Fair enough. I did love that scene with the guy repeatedly shooting himself in the head.
I did too.
I was freaking awesome.
Is that
disturbing
of us?
Maybe. But what else is new?
It's compelling, man. Like and it's like over and over as well, you know, and they keep reacting to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there's a reason it's in there. I'm curious about why, what's driving him to do that, you know? Like I'm not sure that they've necessarily fleshed that out yet.
He told her, right? Or he just told her what he saw or who.
Yeah. It was the ghosts.
Yeah.
That was the callback, right? It was the ghost that kidnaps children or whatever.
Yeah.
That told her to do it, or told him to do it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Which, is that the voice that she heard as well?
Oh, I mean, dude.
That would make sense to me, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Also, I have to ask you guys, you know, they kind of put something out there towards the end where she's, like, shooting at something that she's seeing that's running away. She said it's him, and he reacts, like, really dramatically. So I have to assume that ties into the theory that maybe she's, like, a rape survivor.
Yeah. Yeah, and we kind of talked about that when we talked about the first issue, right? I think that seemed somewhat self-evident based on her nightmares that she was having.
Yeah. Yep. So that's her hell, dude. Like, she's going to, like, see that over and over and over again.
Yeah. Or at least be traumatized by it and then repeat somehow.
Agreed. I love this book. I think I want this to be made into a movie.
Oh, like X-Files-ish style?
Yeah, like X-Files-ish, except good X-Files movies.
Yes.
Not the stuff that they made.
Yeah.
The X-Files movie is good.
No, it's not.
I like it.
All right, well, you're wrong, so it's okay. Listen, I've watched every X-Files episode like a half a dozen times. The movies are not good. But it's fine. You're right to your opinion.
I've watched the TV show once time through past the movie, and I enjoyed the first movie. So, but agree to disagree.
No, that's fine. It's like, you know, when the last season came out and like real X-Files fans kind of hated it. But normal people were like, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing.
Yep.
But yeah, I would love to see this made into a movie. I think it's written so cinematically, though, right? Even the stuff that Ronnie doesn't quite like as much, I think would work well in just to kind of advance the story. Obviously, I feel like it would alienate some people if it was told that way. But I mean, the subject matter is already going to alienate some people anyway. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So
can you see like the first panel of the first issue, if it was shot cinematically, it would be silent with no sound to convey the shock that the dad is going through?
Absolutely.
That would be crazy.
Absolutely. And I think that's why this book is so successful to me, is that it really, like, at its core, it's obviously a horror book, but it really plays with the horror tropes, right? And the horror movies that are the most interesting and the scariest are the ones where you don't see the monsters.
Right.
You just see the reaction of people to stuff around them.
Yep. With the exception of Signs.
Never heard of it. That movie never happened. No, that movie's all right. Matter of fact, I liked it when it came out. Okay. On rewatches, I didn't like it.
Fair enough.
Yeah. All right, so let's rate this one up. Who wants to go? Travis, you kick it off. Give this one a rating for me.
I'll go 4.75 out of 5.
Yeah. Ronnie?
I'm going to go.
Your least favorite?
No, actually, this one did a 180 for me from the first issue, like I said. So I'm going to go 3.5 out of 5.
3.5? What you mean to say is 4.5 out of 5. That's what you meant to say. I loved it. I thought it was great.
It was great. I enjoyed it way more than I did the first one, for sure.
Fair enough.
Okay. Better or worse than Jimmy's Bastards?
I love Jimmy's Bastards.
Jimmy's Bastards is hilarious, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aaron, on the other hand.
Yeah, well, you know. Aaron doesn't like a whole lot of stuff.
I was going to say, he hates everything. That's like, you know, there was that XFL guy that he hates me. Well, if I played in the XFL, then it'd be Aaron hates everything. That'd be the back of my jersey.
All right. Let's go to the next one. Ronnie, I'll let you pick this one.
Let's go with, because we only have two left, so...
Three.
No, we have Baby Teeth and Betrothed.
And Animosity.
I thought Animosity Evo?
Yeah.
I thought that was last week.
No, dude, that's this week.
Okay, anyways, let's go with Betrothed.
All right, Betrothed, number 4. This is written by Sean Lewis, art by Steve Wee, letters by Simon Boland, and this is Ronnie's favorite book.
Yeah, that's pretty close, dude.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Tell me why you like it so much.
I don't know. It's just like one of those fun CWS show type books. Mm. Like everything's, it's not too deep, but everything's right there on the surface, and you know, you can just be in a cool spot, and I think the world is cool, and then the characters themselves are different. It's like a different spin on Romeo and Juliet, which we got the call back in this issue, but
mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like that, I don't know, like Monster Squad style-ish type Goonies feel.
So I really like this issue. I mean, I've enjoyed the series so far, but I think for me, this was one of the more fun issues because there's a lot of action. They're fighting this giant monster thing. Mm-hmm. There's that battle between like the aliens and the betrothed and their crew. And I really dug that. This I don't want to recycle my line, but I watched some anime over the weekend because my brother was here, Julian. He's an anime fanatic. And this is, I mean, obviously the art is anime-ish, I would say.
Yeah.
Very manga-inspired. And I could definitely see this being like just a crazy, all-out Japanese anime. And I really dug that. It's a lot of fun. It's not a deep read, but it's very entertaining.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
True.
I was a little confused, though, how we got from the end of 3 to the beginning of 4.
I mean, didn't they transported at the end of 3 into the whatever pream, the planet, right? Like,
oh, okay.
And they land in the water.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. See, I totally forgot about that. I didn't have enough time to go back and look over 3 before reading 4.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, I think for myself, I wish that they kind of would dive a little bit deeper into the world that they're trying to build on this planet versus kind of the more grounded, you know, stuff that we see on Earth, you know. And, you know, so this issue is a bit of a payoff, I guess, for you know, the alien world. But it's kind of mostly taken up by a battle that is kind of reminiscent of other like Magic V science battles that we've already seen. And you know, like ultimately I don't know that a lot happens in the issue. Like they fight and their guardians basically sacrifice themselves so that they can get away, transport to Earth where they say, you're going to have like home field advantage. Now you're on Earth, but yeah. I don't know necessarily why that's an advantage for them, unless they're going to somehow kind of recruit other people on Earth to back them up or something, you know?
Well, it's kind of like Home Alone, right? He knows his house. Well, I'm just saying. I mean, that might be a dumb analogy, but he knows his house. So
I like
he knows the traps and stuff to do. So they could be like fighting at the school where they know and grew up at. Or their town.
Can somebody
Home Alone,
please,
Ronnie? Like, I'm gonna like take back everything I said about this series.
Somebody, please write Sean Lewis and tell him to put in one of those machines. What are they called? Rube Goldberg machines. Mm-hmm. Have him put that in here. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
The micro machines on the floor and
yeah, the tar and feathering.
Well, you wait when Andy, the fat kid in this book, gets one over on him and he says, you take that, you filthy animal.
Oh, that'd be amazing. I'd be so down for that. it was a good issue, fun issue. I dug it. It's this is like one of those palate cleanser reads, right?
Yep, definitely.
So it's always nice to have. What else do we want to say about this book?
I'm done with it.
I think I would maybe just add that I'm still a little bit confused about the overall premise, you know, like, i.e. that, you know, they ship them off to Earth for 18 years, you know, where they're not at all involved with the ruling of their tribe, where they're going to come in and be the king on day one with no prior experience. So maybe that's a stalling gig, or maybe that is a function of letting them grow to adulthood so they can have a informed decision about, yes, we're going to like marry and, you know, do what we need to do. That would be an interesting twist if that's kind of the way that they go with that plot device. But I'm kind of curious why, from the perspective of everything else that's going on the alien planet, like, basically they start out kind of at a truce, and then, like, the betrothed meet a few days before their wedding, and they transport them back to the planet, and, like, we're going to kill you now, and then sets off a chain of events wherein, like, the science dudes are like, oh, but really, I've always wanted to kill my sister. It just seems like they could have, if they were going to try to betray or be mutinous, they could have done that at any time prior to this, like, milestone coming up. It seems like they procrastinate a little bit before they're like, oh, but really, I've never intended to give up power. And it only just became real, like, the day that it was supposed to happen.
Mm. Yeah. All right, let's rate this one up. I'll take this one. I'll go 3.5 out of 5.
And by three,
I dig it. Not my cup of tea, but I dig it.
I'm going a solid 4.
And I'll go 3 out of 5.
Travis, wrong again. Next up, Animosity Evolution number 6, written by Marguerite Bennett. We have art by Eric Gapster, colors by Rob Schrage P. Schwager, and letters by Marshall Dillon. So this is kind of the aftermath of the robot animals all getting killed. And once again, we kick off with some biblical reference, this time St. Francis, mm-hmm. which I thought was a pretty cool page. Because obviously St. Francis is very much associated with animals, so it made total sense that it would be on here. And I guess I think this maybe ties into that group of humans that we see about halfway through the story, where they seem different than the other humans we've seen, right? It's almost like all the humans we've seen are either just pro-humanity 100% or like slave to humanity as they are in the city by the sea. I don't want to say slave, but they're very much controlled, right? By, oh God, what's her name?
Wintermute.
Very much controlled. And that group that shows up about halfway through the story seemed like they just kind of wanted like a real coexistence, I guess. And maybe that was the point of St. Francis. I enjoy this issue. It seemed to me like it was a lot wordier than most of the other ones.
Yeah.
I guess because we're trying to explain a lot of things at once here. Right. So they try to reestablish what the Lex and Amata are, how we got to that place, who may be responsible for killing them, whether Wintermute is the responsible party or something else. We have the whole scene with the cow and the little mouse, which I really dug as well, kind of figuring out if they should reveal the fact that the cow pushed the button. Right. And then we learned that it's not necessarily the cow. I think I read that right, right?
Yeah.
Because even though the cow blames herself, it was the little mouse that was responsible for the whole thing.
Right. Correct.
Well, I think you could argue she's blaming herself, but I would argue with respect to that point, you know, is it really their fault? Because I feel like they're backed into a corner with a mobster that was like, if you press this button, you'll be fine and your child will be fine. Or you can, you know, not press the button and, you know, like bad stuff's going to happen, you know, and they didn't explicitly spell out that when you're pressing this, all of these animata that, you know, are going to die, you know, like I don't know. I understand that emotions are not rational, but I, you know, from a viewer's perspective, I don't know. They should blame themselves for how it went down, you know?
Well, from the reader's perspective, you're right. But if you put yourself in their shoes, then they would blame themselves. Because, I mean, they did push the button, right? Whether they were trying to save the little calf or whatever is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. they still committed this act. And in particular, in this world that is in such chaos, you know, both people and animals are going to want to find a scapegoat for what happened. I mean, there's always going to be a bad guy, right?
Right.
And for all these people, they would be the bad guy. And getting rid of them would kind of solve the problem, really. That's why the cow's like, we just need to go back to the jackal or whatever he was, because we'll be safe there. And like, we know they're not going to be safe there. The dude's a freaking mobster.
Right.
But at least maybe they won't get killed, because if they stay in the city by the sea, they're going to kill him.
Yeah, because the good and bad lines are blurred, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, too, the lines are blurred among, like, who are we going to eat? Because they kind of basically say that, right? It's like some people are being kept alive, you know, especially people that are in the black market, so that someday, you know, like when stuff gets really bad, they can turn around and eat them.
Sure.
You know, they kind of make reference to that. You know, I think for me, the central question is, you know, how much is Wintermute responsible for all of this? And, you know, maybe in a broader sense, like, is Wintermute the villain or not? You know, because there's a lot of intrigue floating around in this issue and others. Like, how did she manage to save herself when everybody else was eliminated, but also knows that, you know, Olivia or whatever, Octavia and Penny were the ones that did it. I think there's, for me, a question about, you know, who killed Goliath. My assumption would be that maybe since the farmers didn't do it, that Wintermute did it so that she could have a gigantic horse animata, who's loyal to her, that she could recruit for the secret police. So I think a lot of how you take this series to me is about, is Wintermute, you know, like, well-intentioned and really looking after everybody's best interest, or is she a total monster and like it's all horrific?
Well, I mean, to bring this to, like, real life. Sorry, Ronnie.
No, go for it.
Isn't that kind of like how we view government at all times?
Yeah.
Right? So, like, when Obama was president, so people loved him. So people were like, oh, this guy's the worst. Like, he's killing the economy and this and that and the other. And now Trump's president, and you have people that love Trump, and there's people that are like, oh, Trump's the worst. He's a freaking dictator, whatever.
Yeah.
The same kind of thing. And I mean, it's tough to be in a position of ultimate power like this, right? Like, we as a society have checks and balances, but the society in animosity does not have that. Right. Everyone looks up to whoever the leader is to make the right choice for the group. And sometimes those choices aren't the best choices for everybody. Right. Like, there's people that are going to die of starvation. There's people that are going to get killed. And that's just the way it is in order to keep some kind of order in the society.
Yeah. It's better to cut 50 people than a million people type thing.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think, I don't know if maybe it ties conceptually into what you were talking about earlier in a way, where you're kind of talking about slavery, right? You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, in a sense, you know, kind of we're looking at a government that's basically totalitarian, right? Like, we control your labor, and if you don't do what we say, then we kill you. You know, that's kind of how Wintermute's state is operating, you know, and maybe they look the other way for, you know, as long as they can. But there, I think, is an idea that at some point they might run out of food and stuff would start to get more serious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you can think about the overall picture, too. If Wintermute wasn't doing what she's doing, then would they be in a place now where they don't have food? And it's just utter chaos on the streets, right? Like, they're already rioting and stuff. Would we have already been in that place if she didn't have this machinery going, right? Like, that's a tough call, because we know from real life that a lot of times totalitarian governments don't do the best things for their people. And, you know, we could say that, hey, like, Wintermute as an animal is kind of following the path of, like real life human dictators. But you know, the situation is also very different in this world than in our world.
Yeah, I mean, it eventually breaks down into a ethical debate, right?
Sure.
You know, kind of like, basically, is it okay to directly, essentially murder people to save more people? You know, that mm-hmm. like, that's Wintermute's life. So depending on how you interpret those things, like that's how you come down on her as a character.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Any last words on Animosity Evolution?
Nope, I'm good.
Yeah, I think I'm good.
Cool. So I'll go ahead and rate it up first. I'm going to give it a 5 out of 5. As always. This series is really strong. Actually, I did have one more thing, but I'll let you guys rate it up before we move on.
I'll go 4.5 out of 5. Definitely, you know, a strong series, and especially kind of paired with the Animosity proper, you know, I think they're both super strong right now.
Yep, I'm right there with you. I'll go 4.5 out of 5, too.
So my question to you guys is, I don't remember this because it's been so long, but what's the girl from Animosity?
Jesse.
Are her and Adam related?
It's never been said that they were.
Because there's a couple panels in this where Adam is talking to the bat, Kikiriki.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, my mom's dead, my dad's dead, and my half sister is somewhere across the country. I don't know like where she's at.
Yeah. This could be the brother that Sandor's trying to get her to.
Interesting. Now it all makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it hasn't been explained that way.
Yeah, but it wasn't explained.
But yeah, I took that as that connection to Jesse and Sandor too. So like, yeah. I mean, we always do this, but it's like Fear of the Walking Dead versus The Walking Dead, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like this season, Morgan from The Walking Dead's on Fear of the Walking Dead to show. To show the continuity. Yeah.
I got to catch up on that show. That show's really good.
Yeah. So yeah, throwing little tidbits here and there of Animosity proper would be pretty awesome.
I like it. Yeah. I saw that one thing and I was like, what the? Wait, what? Yeah. Is this the tie-in? Yeah, cool. Do you guys think he's dead, by the way?
No.
Okay. Just making sure. Final book of the night is the one and only Baby Teeth, number 11, written by Donnie Cates, art by Gary Brown, colors by Mark Englert, and letters by Taylor Esposito. Despacito. I'm sure he or she's never heard that before.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. All right, so this is a flash forward from issue 10. We're in the future a couple months, and this is a good issue, really good issue, really strong. We're getting ready to go into the Red Realm.
Yeah,
and everyone's like a total badass.
Yeah, especially Olivia.
Yeah, Olivia. I was not expecting that at all.
Yeah, when she put everybody in check, I was like, yes, that is awesome.
Yeah, because Sadie's like, I'm going to go and get my sister and my kid right now. She's like, okay, you might be ready. We'll see. You know, her dad's like, no, there's no way you're not ready. She's like, yeah, check it out. I've been doing target practice, and like, there's not a single shot in the middle of the target. And Olivia's like, eh, you might be ready, you might not. How about this? You fight my one-armed kid, and if you can beat him, then we'll go right now. And she kind of gets her butt whooped by a one-armed 10-year-old.
Well, an ex-Antichrist, right?
Well, sure.
So, I mean, let's give Sadie some credit there. But I was talking about past that, where Sadie's still fired up about going, and Olivia, like, yanks her to the side and says that she's not effing with her and that she'll beat her ass, and there isn't a thing that her dad will do about it, but just pray that she'll stop. I was like, oh, yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Well, and I mean, she went through some pretty serious stuff, right? Like, we get the flashback scenes to when she was in the Red Realm with her kid,
mm-hmm.
and the stuff that they went through. And I like the way that there's some there's obvious rules in the Red Realm, right? So she talks about how most of the animals and creatures there would leave her son alone because he was like the ruler of the Red Realm. Mm-hmm. But they would constantly attack her because they were just she was fresh meat to them,
yep.
Except for like a couple of creatures. And that's how the kid lost his arm, right? Like he was grabbed by this octopus thing in the rocks and couldn't free him, so she cut his arm off.
Yeah.
And that's how Sadie's like, okay, maybe I'm not ready yet, right? Because Olivia's like, are you ready to do whatever it takes to save your son, including chopping his arm off? And, you know, Sadie's not ready for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that makes me curious, I think, about, you know, what the kind of creatures that are not allied with, you know, the Antichrist, et cetera, in the Red Realm, like what their kind of objective is with the Chosen, you know, like if they get their hands on them, like what would they do with them? You know,
well, they don't even mess with them. Right. Except for
well, they're trying to they're trying to grab Simon, right? Like the rhino squid has him in the tentacles and he's trying to pull him in. For something.
Yeah, well, that's because Olivia says that the rhino squid isn't very smart, and it's just a dumb beast or whatever. But the other ones just don't attack him at all. And, okay, his name's Simon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Follow me here. So if he's in the Red Realm, and he is the ruler or the Antichrist, wouldn't it be Simon Says? I thought that was pretty funny, actually. Like, I mean, maybe it was supposed to be like that, maybe not. I don't know, but it's kind of a cool play on words type thing.
Well, so what I get out of Simon is Simon was in the Bible the brother of Jesus, mm-hmm. So that's why to me it would make sense to make him the Antichrist because he would be the direct opposite of Jesus.
Right. Correct.
But there's no Clark in the Bible, so I don't know how that works.
No.
Maybe Donnie Cates. Like, had some bully in high school named Clark.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
Or maybe it's a play on Clark Kent.
Oh, okay.
Maybe. That's what they said, right? When she named him, she's like...
Oh, yeah, because she loved comics.
They're like, oh, you named him after your grandpa. And it's like, yep. Or I named him after Superman. Whatever. Yeah, let's go with the thing you said.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot about that, because she had she had Batman and Superman posters in her room.
Yeah.
Dude. Yeah. Okay. But I'm curious, though, since we're talking about Simon, like kind of about like her story and Olive's story after they get back to Earth, like, A, how they get back to Earth somehow from the Red Realm. And then once they're there, I guess they install themselves with a group that ostensibly exists to protect them.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. While they're active.
So there's
anyways.
Something there, and also kind of. Like, what's going on with Simon now, you know, like, I guess he didn't go through the whatever the trials are that, like, the previous group, like would have put the Chosen through. Like, mm-hmm. He'd have to do that because he went to the Red Realm, but now he's back and he's still got powers or he's just, like, good with a bat.
Well, see, I took it as this might be wrong, but... Like, when Clark was born, he was deactivated, or he wasn't considered one of the Antichrist anymore, so he didn't have his powers anymore.
Huh. See, I feel almost like them going to the Red Realm is what forced this group to create a new Antichrist.
Hmm. Okay.
Because, I mean, like, obviously he's still got some abilities, right? He hasn't aged.
Yeah. And Olivia did say that he was immortal.
Right.
But just, I mean... Ra's al Ghul's immortal, but he doesn't have superpowers, though.
Well, first of all, thank you for saying his name correctly. And second, you're right.
So, I mean, that's just how I took it, is that at first he was the Antichrist, and then when he went into the Red Realm, or came out of the Red Realm, however you want to look at it, and Clark was born, then he stopped being the Antichrist, but the remnants of being the Antichrist are... past Antichrist was him being immortal.
Yep, I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, that maybe that could line up, you know, especially with respect to the, like, kind of the time distortion in the Red Realm, so yeah. That, like, basically, you know, if significant time elapsed between when Clark was born and when they get out of the Red Realm, like even more time passes for Olive in the Red Realm. And
yeah,
Clues, she's already old. So I do like that idea that he's deactivated now. And that might speak to kind of his apparent characterization here, where he's like kind of a good boy. Like he does what Mama says, you know, she's telling him what to do and not vice versa.
Yeah. But see, like, even though he's 10 and never ages, I don't know if his mindset ever goes past being 10, like a 10-year-old mind.
Mm. Well, I mean, he's going to feel the need to follow his mom because they were in the Red Realm for whatever much time. You know, he aged like 10 years. She aged like 40. And like, he's going to feel a connection to his mom because all he had when he was there was her.
Right.
So I understand why he would follow all her orders when they're back on Earth. I am curious. I mean, you mentioned like his state of mind. I wonder, like, the things that he's going through, knowing that he had all this power and this crazy future as like an all powerful leader, and now he's just a kid, right? Like, I wonder if that's messed him up in some way.
Yep, could be.
Yeah, I'm also curious, just tangentially, to you guys as parents, about the concept of like your kids being like young ass kids forever. Is that a fun thing? Or?
No, I would hate that. Grow up and get the hell out of my house.
Exactly.
Especially Ronnie. He's got high school kids.
Yep. Only a couple more years.
Uh-huh. I hear you, buddy. Our oldest is going to high school in August, so I'm with you. I'm with you.
So if we fast forward to the end of this book, though, and we see the time distortion in the Red Realm, so the purple raccoon looks more like a purple battle cat.
Yes.
and Heather is badass, obviously, because she's been badass this whole book.
Uh-huh.
But is she bald?
Yeah, it looked like it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then now Clark's a toddler with a faux hawk.
Yeah. Yeah, they better hurry up, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's been a couple months, and he looks like he's maybe three or four.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah. I think they'll be okay. I mean, obviously, Heather's a badass to begin with, so there was no growing into becoming a badass like Olivia had to go through.
Right.
So I think Heather's attitude will be a little bit different. Plus, they have the raccoon there, and the raccoon is freaking awesome. So, yeah. They should do like an all raccoon episode or all raccoon issue.
Just raccoon like zero?
An entirely silent issue with the raccoon.
Well, I wonder if issue 12 isn't going to be them three in the Red Realm.
I'd love that. I mean, that's what I said at the end of issue 10, right? I want the story in the Red Realm.
Yeah.
Like, if we don't see anybody else but Heather and Clark and the raccoon for a couple issues, I'm totally down for that.
Yeah.
All right. Let's rate this one up. Ronnie, I'll let you go first.
This book is 13 out of 5, like normal.
Yeah, it is.
I just love everything about it, and it just keeps building on top of itself over and over and over.
I'm glad you said that. I know you've been down on some other Donnie Cates stuff lately, and it makes me sad because I think Donnie Cates is an awesome person, an awesome writer. I also love this. 55 out of 5 for me.
Hey, I never said that he is an awesome person or awesome
That's
writer.
That's true. That's true. You never said that.
Travis?
And I'll go a modest 5 out of 5.
A modest?
Yeah.
Well, one of us three has to be level-headed, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to ground you guys.
See, we have a recurring theme in this episode, and Travis is wrong again. 5 out of 5 is too low. Next week, we have The Lost City of Explorers. City Explorers. Zach Kaplan, Alvaro Soresca, Chris Blythe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hell yeah, dude.
I can't wait to read that.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. It's like the Goonies meets, meets the Goonies in the 21st century. It's going to be great.
It's the millennial Goonies.
Yeah, there you go.
That's what Zach said, so I'm going with it.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. Very excited for that. All right. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us all on Twitter. Ronnie's at Rumbar316. Travis is at The Great Magnet. I'm at Geekvine. The show is at Aftershock Pod. There's a Facebook group, the Aftershock Comics Fans Group. There's an email address that I don't remember, and Ronnie can tell you. See you next week.
Shock the world.